Hello, and thank you for listening to the Teaching Math Teaching Podcast. The Teaching Math Teaching Podcast is sponsored by the Association of MathMax Teacher Educators, a community of math teacher educators learning to teach math teachers better. I'm your co-host, Joel Amidon, and joining me is Dusty Jones. Dusty, how are you?
I'm doing great, Joel. Thanks.
And we're also joined by Jen Wolf. Jen, how are you?
Feeling good. That semester's starting to wind down a little bit simultaneously wrapping up. Good to be with you all.
Winding down, wrapping up, whatever, you know, we can put them all together.
Right?
But today it's awesome because we get to have a conversation with Dr. Nirmala Naresh, who is an associate professor of MathMax education at the University of North Texas. We are talking to Nirmala to share her advice and expertise on being a MathMax teacher educator, as well as gaining insight on next year's AMTE conference, because she is the associate vice president for the annual conference program for the 2025 conference in Reno, Nevada. Welcome, Nirmala. How are you?
I'm just fine. First of all, thank you so much, Joel, Dusty, and Jen for having me here. It's very exciting, but I can gauge the nervousness degree is like high up there. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm very excited to be here sharing my thoughts with you all. So the only thing I would like to add is I began my teaching career, I would say, what, many years ago. 90s is when I started teaching in a first grade classroom. About to say 24 wide-eyed first graders were in the classroom. That's the first classroom in which I taught.
Wow.
So I'm very excited. I was very excited then. I'm super excited now every time I step into a classroom, always looking for opportunities to learn and grow with my students. So yeah, I'll say that.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you for filling in some of the blanks for us there. And again, saying some of those, you know, end of a semester, but also your AMTE obligations. We appreciate any time that you can share for the benefit of this conversation. So how did you start teaching math teachers?
Like I just said, I started teaching mathematics many years ago, but the first time I was introduced to the field of math teacher education was during my doctoral program at Illinois State University. So that was in year 2004. Mm. So I was an international student enrolled in the doctoral program by the then doctoral advisor, Dr. Norma Presnick. So mm-hmm. I had this one-on-one meeting with her, and she was very warm and compassionate. And she helped me all the way through to get into the programs, you know, figure out the paperwork and all that stuff. So everything was taken care of. So that first day as a doctoral candidate, I experienced a whirlwind of emotions, just like how I'm experiencing it now.
Yeah.
Mix of nervousness as well as excitement, because I was returning to school almost after a decade.
Yeah.
And that too in a completely new cultural setting. So I didn't know what to expect, but I know that I wanted to do this because I was so longing to re-enter the teaching profession that I loved so, so much, but I couldn't. So this program gave me an opportunity to do that. So before that, in my previous teaching experience, I mostly taught mathematics courses to different student groups, ranging from elementary students, high school students, international students who came to India to study math from Nepal, and also to engineering mathematics majors who were at a minority serving institution. By that I mean, they came from a neighboring state to our state, but they didn't speak the same language. We all didn't speak the same language. That's why the institution, community college, that's what it was, a minority serving community college. So that's where I was teaching mathematics. So that's what I've been doing, teaching mathematics all along. Through this doctoral program, I was transitioning into the landscape of math teacher education, and that marked a significant shift in my teaching journey.
Yeah.
So I still remember during that first semester there. So the model was that we mentor with a professor in a teacher education course, and then the next semester we get to teach that course. So we were mentored thoroughly. So I was sitting in that math course. It was math for elementary teachers, I believe number one, and participated in class discussion along with learners who are called prospective teachers of mathematics. That's a new terminology to me. Mm-hmm. And I realize there'll be many more terminologies for me to learn from that point onwards. During those sessions, I had the opportunity to witness firsthand how to approach teaching mathematics to teachers. This was interesting to me because the way the mathematics was presented to prospective teachers, rather than a traditional, straightforward approach to teaching mathematics, which was the norm in my prior teaching experiences, right? And that was rewarded well as well. Here, the instructor, who was also my professor, she did not position herself as the center of authority in the classroom. She was walking around the classroom, observing students, asking questions, generating discussions, inviting students to come to the center of the room to make presentations. Really? Can you do that? I don't remember ever doing that. I would be very nervous if the teacher called my name in the classroom. I tried to be like a fly on the wall in the classrooms, not get into trouble. Because there I grew up in my classrooms, if the teacher called your name, it's not a good thing necessarily. So either it's for punishment or you did really, really something bad. Coming from that, seeing a dynamic classroom like this, I was trying to soak it all in. And students were working with each other in a very collaborative and respectful manner, using lots of hands-on tools. There was a big cabinet in the classroom where students just freely went, opened the things, took what they needed, put them back. This was all new to me, right? So I was very excited to learn a lot of things. I also participate in the weekly instructor meetings, and that's where the other instructors of this particular course came together. So we were looking at the curriculum, we were looking at the problems. There was discussion on which problem to use for the next class session. They were evaluating the strengths of each problem. They were anticipating student responses, and they were talking about assessment strategies and so much more. This was all intriguing to me as an international student. Yeah. Was never experienced this sort of learning and teaching, to be very honest. So there was so much to take in and learn. I found it to be very fascinating. My prior experiences in teaching had laid a strong foundation, but I realized that there was much, much, much more to learn. So I realized that teaching mathematics for teachers requires the nuanced approach. And the focus is not only on math content, but also the pedagogy of math instruction. So I was slowly getting myself ready to embrace the identity of a math teacher educator. So, yeah.
I was like just trying to keep track of like possibly all the cognitive shifts that were happening, you know, like with the, you know, thinking about, you know, in a different culture, you know, than in a different language possibly. And then thinking about the, even like, okay, but the math teaching was okay. Now the math teaching is a little bit different. And then now I'm taking the perspective of the teacher. I mean, like you could tick them off and it's like, that's a lot happening. Like the world is shifting all at the same time. Like, I mean, just like, how did you deal with all, I mean, how are you processing that? I mean, was there a mix of excitement, but then also, you know, nervous? I don't know, like just processing all that.
It was challenging, I will tell you that. The Illinois State University was located in Bloomington, Illinois, and I lived in Peoria, Illinois, which was like an hour 45 miles away. And I did not know how to drive back then. So I would commute. I would take the intercity transportation. So I would take a local bus from my apartment to the bus depot, the central depot, mm-hmm. and then take the intercity bus from Peoria, Illinois to Bloomington, Illinois. So I would leave home around 7-ish in the morning. My son was almost 2 years old at the time. So I was also grappling with all of these things. So dropping him off at the daycare, take the buses, commute. So that commute time was like my Zen time. So I would organize my thoughts. Mm-hmm. The classes that I taught, they were mostly in the mornings because that's when students came to take classes. And then after I finished teaching, I will do other preparing for a next class or grading. I would do all of that. And I would also network with other grad students in my cohort. So I did all of that. And then my classes, the grad classes usually are in the evenings. They wouldn't start until 6 p.m. So I had this long break time. So that's when I would catch up with schoolwork, right? I'm also enrolled in about nine hours of classes as an international student. I needed to maintain those hours.
That's
what I did. So I had this time. the travel time, and then this gap in between the classes that I taught and the classes that I took. So that I used the time, you know, to organize myself, to catch up on schoolwork, and also ask questions with my peers, rest as needed. And then the classes usually are over by 8:39, and my husband would bring my son in the Toyota Corolla. That was her first car. I remember that. He would be fast asleep, right? It's 9. So I would just rush to see him because I haven't seen him since morning. So yeah, I just feel almost tear up now. But anyways, that's what I did for almost a semester. So I would just wait to see his face at the end of the long day after 2 or 3 times a day is what I did. The person that scheduled the classes was very considerate and compassionate, and they knew my situation. So they either gave me 2 days a week or 3 days a week sessions. So the classes that I was assigned, they were aligned very well with the classes that I took. So I don't have to be on campus for every day of the week. Yeah. So there was a lot of help the way. There was a lot of support from my mentors and professors, of course, my my cohort. So yeah, that's how I processed and I grew.
So with all that, like, what was the best advice you received when you started engaging in this teaching of math teachers?
Oh, there was a lot that I've received over the past 2 decades.
Well, what's the when you first started? Like, what was like? And again, maybe with thinking about this shift that was happening and thinking about teaching mathematics and now teaching math teachers and then stepping into that role. Like, what was that like? What stands out to you is that piece of advice that that you received?
It was one. It sounds simple, but later I realized that that's super powerful. So one of the things that they said was, I never carry a pen or pencil with me when I'm teaching in a classroom. I don't carry that with me. I thought, why would they say something like that? Why does it matter to have a pen or pencil with you or not? Like, actually carry it in your hand is what they said. It seemed like a minor detail, right? But later on, I realized how powerful it was. Because as a math teacher, what I've always done is I have this urge, right, to step in and provide immediate help when I see a learner struggling. I've done that. I've done that either in front of a blackboard in my previous teaching career, write up things on the blackboard very clearly, not missing any single step, make sure the equalities are all lined up nicely. So pay attention to details. So that's something that naturally comes to me. That's what I was asked to do, that I was trained to do. I was rewarded for doing that. The advice to not carry a pen or pencil during class time, it's not just about the tool, right? It's more than they're telling me, resist the temptation to solve problems for your students. I think that was the hidden message, right, that they were getting at. So I learned the importance of then centering learners as active participants in the mathematical process. So not carrying a pen or pencil with me means don't do it for them. Let them support them so they can figure it out on their own. What this also meant that we need to share power in the classroom, right? So that the construction of mathematical ideas becomes a collective responsibility. It doesn't always have to rest with the teacher of mathematics. So the goal was then to create an environment where students are empowered to take ownership of their learning, so they can develop a deeper understanding and appreciation for the teaching and learning of mathematics. So that I thought was very powerful. Another important piece of advice that I received was, this was when I started teaching in my first tenure track job. First semester of teaching, I did that. I thought I did a fantastic job. I moved from Illinois to Ohio. I thought I did a fabulous job, but then the first semester teaching evaluations came. It's just scathing remarks from students, terrible numbers. It's just, I just thought, okay, this is a terrible idea. I'm not cut out for this. I don't even know why I came to this career. I was sinking in this hole of depression, right? And then my mentor, one of my mentors came to me and said, you're not alone in this process. We've all gone through this at some stage or the other. So they encouraged me to go back and look at the student feedback again. And I did that. When I did that, I noticed that the students were actually trying to give me a useful piece of advice. They were telling me actually what worked for them and what didn't work for them. Yes, obviously there were some that were unflattering, but for the most part, they were considerate and they were telling me what they appreciated and what they thought I could have done better. When I read it the first time, it wasn't clear to me. I was just focusing on the negative. I was not wearing my growth mindset hat. Yeah. I was focusing on the deficits. But then when I read that the second time and the third time, I realized, they were just telling me that you were doing things right, but they just didn't understand why I was asking them to do certain things. Perhaps preface them with a rationale for why I asked them to do the things that they did. So when I asked them to go and investigate a historical mathematical task that focuses on geometry, they were in the course teaching geometry for middle school teachers. That's the course. But then they didn't understand the connection between the course content and the activity that I was trying to facilitate. And I realized that I didn't do it well. So providing a rationale or building a discussion on why that activity that I was trying to facilitate made more sense to them. Why does it align well with the course content? I think that would have made it a more meaningful activity rather than just bringing a handout and telling them, hey, here's what we are going to do today, and this is due next week. So it's easy to ask the questions when it comes to mathematics itself, right? So why does this step make sense to you? Why? How did you get this equation? Can you tell me how you solved this particular problem? That was easy to me. But then to do that for my own teaching decisions, it didn't come naturally to me. Yeah. And I realized that I needed to start doing that to the pedagogy of instruction as well. So that also I appreciate greatly.
Well, and also too, like, right, you're being meta because like you're training up teachers to show, hey, here's why I'm doing this. I want to show you my pedagogical moves. So you have reasons behind your pedagogical moves, and they're not just doing activity to activity. And what are the connections between them? So
exactly.
That's good.
You summarized that very well.
Yeah. Yeah. The not carrying a pencil thing. That's, I mean, I don't know if Dusty and Jen, if that resonated with you all, because it's like, I like doing it. Like, hey, like if someone needs some help, like I'll step in. I want to step in, but it's like, I know what you just said is true. Like not, you know, taking that, just removing myself and making sure, again, I'm not solving problems for somebody else.
Yeah, that's hard. I mean, I've shared earlier what I want to do, like one of my core things is I want to help other people. But yeah. Sometimes I think helping means we'll step in and do that thing for that person. But that's, if we're trying to teach people something, they need to do that themselves in a lot of cases. So yeah, mm-hmm. I like that idea of not having the pencil to not have that, not be ready to just step in, you know. I mean, that might not stop me from taking a pencil from someone else, but that would, I'd have to check myself, you know, on that.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's so important. I mean, I think, you know, you go into math because you get really excited about doing the math, right? So you carry it around and you want to help students out, but it's not so helpful. So like when I work with my pre-service teachers, I'm like, you have the harder job of trying to figure out what are the good questions as assessing and advancing probing questions that you could be asking instead of taking that pencil and doing the work, right? Who's doing the work? Are you doing the work or are the students doing the work, right?
Yeah. Like when my daughter says the six words that I really love to hear, Dad, I need help with math. I'm like, get ready to have some fun here. but also knowing too, like, hey, no, it's not about me doing some, what we're doing right now. We're doing a lot of trig ratios and things like that, which is very exciting, but making sure she's doing trig ratios and she sees the excitement as well, which is hopefully that she can just, you know, feel the excitement that's coming from me anyway. But those are awesome, pieces of advice. And thank you for sharing them. What is the one word or phrase or quote that helps you center the work you do in teaching math teachers?
This is something that my language teacher taught us when we were in primary grades, elementary grades. He said that I'll give you the translation and then I'll also say that in my language, if that's allowed.
Absolutely.
What one knows can be fit in the palm of your hand. And whereas the unknown is the size of the universe. So this in that language is katradu kai man alavu, kalladadu ulaga alavu. So I thought that's an extremely important perspective to take. In general, you know, even my way of life, I try to remind myself that even though you are in this position, in this particular setting, what you know is only this much. Mm-hmm. There is so much that there is to be learned. And I think that has always helped me stay grounded, be willing to learn and listen. I don't know if I do that well, but I try to remind myself constantly every now and then when I feel that what just happened in there. The person was trying to communicate something and then I just projected my views on them. And then I back up and say, I just lost sight of that profound saying. Mm. So that's something that I try to remind myself. Along with that, what goes with that is another saying. We read a lot of literature, Tamil literature growing up. So another important saying is what we call Thirukkural. It's two line verses. There is 1,330 of them and couplet 396. It's just a literature piece. So they say that in the sandy soil, the deep you delve, you are able to reach the water springs. The same way, when you learn more, delve deeper, the freer the streams of wisdom will flow. So this is also another thing that has always kept me motivated. I want to learn more with my peers, with you, with my students. So wherever I am, I believe that there is always an opportunity to be a better person, better teacher educator, better professional. So with that mindset, I don't shy away from asking for help when I need that. I know that puts me in an extremely vulnerable situation, and it has. Sometimes when I take that stance, it feels as if that you're not valued because you come off as a weak person. And then I have to pause and think, do I have to renounce that stand and take a more confident stance? And then I debate between, do you stay truer to your values or do you adjust yourself, you modify yourself as a person and then conform? And I have engaged in this debate so many times and I've realized I've made peace with the fact that it's very important for me to stay true to my values. So it doesn't matter how I'm perceived by others. It's very important that I remain true to myself. And I think that's more important to me than anything else. So whether it's in my teaching of mathematics with community college students or teaching of mathematics to pre-service teachers or working with in-service teachers or working with my peers on projects, I've aged and grown. Teaching contexts have shifted. Sociocultural settings have transformed. My professional identity also has continuously mm-hmm. evolved. But what has perhaps remained constant is my quest for knowledge about what is mathematics? How do you define mathematics? What is the role of mathematics in the society? And how does it change from one setting to another? And what does it mean to teach mathematics, depending on your perception of what mathematics is? And I think that question actually has haunted me. It continues to drive me till today. The definition of mathematics and how one's perception of what mathematics is driving the way they present it to a learner. To answer these questions, I just dig deeper into the world of math education research, math education pedagogy. So I still continue to read and learn. What I've been trying to do recently is trying to connect the literature that's available here to the literature that's mine. Go back to my roots and try to find bridges to connect the two. That's what I'm doing. If I had unlimited time and no restrictions on what I'm supposed to be doing, no annual evaluations or anything, that's what I will do for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Well, man, I'm just listing the, you know, the piece of advice that we've gotten so far. But if, you know, I have colleagues that have just started this year, so we start to think about like, what advice would I give to someone else starting out in this role, and thinking about what I've shared a colleague who's about to finish their first year. But what's a piece of advice you would share to somebody who's just starting, like in today, right now, that was just starting out with teaching math teachers? What advice would you share?
Obviously, they have to develop their expertise on math knowledge for teaching mathematics. That goes without saying. Most math teacher educator preparation programs focus on MKTT, just as we focus on MKT for our teachers. So that goes without saying. So I'm not going to say a lot about that. What has helped me is that one needs to find for themselves their calling in math teacher educations, in addition to the expected lines of inquiry and job requirements. That's publish, teach, serve. In addition to that, what else can you do to make this math teacher education field your own? How can you personalize it? So that's what I ask my students to do. Because it's different, right? Yeah. Your lived experiences are different than mine. They are unique for each individual. And that's what is going to guide their professional journey in some sense. I look back on my journey, and I was heavily inspired by many of my teachers. My father, who was my first teacher, he not only taught me, but my friends from school. Remember, I still remember sitting on the floor of our apartment living room, and then three or four of us waiting for our dad to come from his job, doing the homework and all of that stuff. So that's my first teacher, my elementary school teacher, Mrs. Sugantha, who insisted that we all call her sister. That's how we still remember her today. She was our math teacher, but she was also the school principal. Firm, strict, but also very matronly. Mrs. Janicki, who was my eighth grade teacher, late 50s, frail looking woman. She held command over a classroom of 80 plus students standing in the front of the classroom. A very small square blackboard. It was pin drop silence in the classroom as we learned strategies for factoring algebraic equations. To Dr. Norma Presmick, who introduced me to the world of ethnomathematics and multicultural mathematics that had a profound impact on my own career trajectory as an MTE. I think all of these teachers have guided me in some way. I don't think back in elementary school or back in high school, I value those teachers so much. But as I grow now, looking back on those experiences, I realize that somehow they had influenced me in the things that they do. So the point I'm trying to make is that your lived experiences are unique, whether you recognize or not. In some way, they've impacted you and molded you as a human and as a professional. And I think it's very important for us to find that niche in our teacher education practice.
That's good. I mean, I'm curious. I'm checking with our co-hosts here, but like mining your own experiences and thinking back where you're saying like some of your experiences before, like, oh, wow, those were pretty meaningful mile markers. I just didn't maybe realize it at the time. I don't know, Jen or Dusty, does either of that like resonate with you? Do you have something that you're like, oh, like I've thought about it. Like that was something that at the time I didn't think so much about it, but now it's like, that's kind of a cornerstone right now.
I think, so I was a theater kid in high school and I really enjoyed performing and I enjoyed memorizing and memorization really helped me out learning mathematics in elementary school, middle school, high school. You know, memorize your multiplication tables. No problem. That's me. I've got that done. Memorize how to find the standard deviation from a set of data. Okay. I can do that. I can memorize that. That did help me out until I started teaching math teachers. And then I was like, wait, why do we do that? Because not everyone was inclined to use memorization as a tool. And so I think even being comfortable talking in front or performing in front of a group of people has helped me teach, has helped me, you know, give presentations, has helped me just talk on this podcast, you know, of not being afraid to just join in. So those are some of those, you know, trying to think how my lived experiences have molded me. I think those are some thoughts that come to mind for me.
What about you, John?
That's a big question. Like thinking back, I think immediately what comes to mind is I think about how I had different mentors and the ways that I'm recognizing how they use their sphere of influence to uplift others. And so now where I am in my career, I think about what are the ways that people were able to amplify and uplift me in ways, and like, what roles and responsibilities do I have now within my sphere of influence to be able to do the same thing? And so I think there's these moments I reflect back on like, what did mentors do for me? What did peers do for me? And what did I learn from those experiences so that now I can think about the way I can use my sphere to kind of uplift and amplify?
Yeah, that's cool. Like mine was a little bit more in this, you know, what you were saying, like, got me thinking about an experience, because I just had an exchange with my son about he was in a college math class and maybe needs a little encouragement and stuff. And so I was remembering my like hardest math class that I ever had, where the professor tricked us. He said, like, if you memorize, and going back to doesn't, if you know all the vocabulary, like, you, I guarantee you a C in this class. I'm like, done. And like, but like, he tricked it because he knew if we knew the vocabulary, we would not, like, we would understand the problems, and then we would better able to struggle with the actual math of it rather than what is this thing even asking me? Mm-hmm. Right. And it was like he got us. And I was like, and so I just shared that with my son, but I was like, it was one of those things where they thought about like Magdalene Lampert's book with, and she talked about like helping people participate in spaces. Right. And so like, if we don't know the practices or the vocabulary or the words, or like, you know, what does it mean to study, as she would say in that book, like, then we're there's a disconnect. And so like, he was like, hey, I'm going to facilitate this connection, learn the vocabulary. And it was like, oh, now you're more connected to what we're actually trying to do in this class. So I love that idea about mining your own lived experiences. And like, again, like you're listing more and more. That was really good. So, but hey, now you're a facilitator of some of these experiences in what you're doing in preparing for a future experience at the 2025 conference. Y'all like that transition? That was pretty good. Anyway.
A plus, Joel.
Yeah, thank you. So proposals for the 2025 conference are going to be due in the middle of May. What can you share with us about the upcoming conference that folks should know who are considering submitting a proposal? Because it's not too late, right? When this episode is going to be released, it'll be time. So people can get it, get some people together, put a proposal together. So what do you have to share, Nirmala?
The first thing that I want to say is that the proposals are due on May 15th, 11:59 p.m. Pacific time. So I don't know exactly when this is going to air, but that's the deadline by which the proposals need to be sent in. The proposals need to be submitted through All Academic Portal. Just like past year, you will have to create a new user ID and login, and then create your account. And then when you're ready, submit the proposal. Before I point out the changes to this year's proposal submission system, I want to acknowledge the feedback that has poured in from multiple corners. So I think I'm very fortunate this year that we've had extensive feedback from the equity committee that's been studying the proposals that were submitted in the past 5 years. So they came to us with a long list of recommendations. We had a significant input from our membership survey that we administered right after the conference. So we took that feedback into consideration as well. We also had generous input from the AMT board. We had input from the technology committee. So that's a lot of feedback to read, analyze, understand, and process, and then make a decision. There's about 12 of us plus more in the committee, along with Rick Hudson, who's the VP of Professional Learning. So we all came together to look through all these recommendations. And most of those recommendations made sense. Some of those fell under the purview of this committee. Some of those, that's up to a broader committee board's decision. So the one thing that we found quite useful is that to broaden the definition of MTEs that serve in a variety of roles, to include coaches, consultants, specialists, teacher leaders, along with university and community college faculty. So you will see that language in the proposal, because this includes MTEs that serve in a variety of important roles. Another feedback was in terms of being more inclusive of the current and evolving interactions between math education and other related fields, right? Math education, stats education, those seem to be natural partners, but we also have these emerging fields of data science education, STEAM education, exceptional education, and interdisciplinary education. So you will see that in the proposal that this is highlighted prominently. So we are inviting presentations that focus on an intersection of practice and research in teacher education, with overlaps in any of these teacher education fields. We also encourage presentations that span early childhood because the Equity Committee's data analysis indicate that there is a paucity in that area. So mm-hmm. we've also stated specifically that we encourage presentations that span early childhood, K through 12, as well as post-secondary context. So you will see revised language that pertains to each of these recommendations. The National Technology Leadership Initiative has its own paragraph in the call for proposals. If you're planning to do a technology presentation earlier last year, they will have to check a box if they want their proposal to be considered for the National Technology Leadership Initiative. This year, they are doing a different, they're adopting a different approach. So they are going to screen the proposals for the word technology. So they have their own process. So I would encourage the membership to read more about that paragraph,
yeah.
about the NTLI initiative that came directly from the technology committee. So those are some of the overarching changes that we have done. Now, to the specific changes about the proposals themselves. What used to be 40 words earlier is now 100 words.
For the description?
For the description of the proposal. The reason is that the membership feedback from conferences have indicated that the description would say something, but then the presentation would be completely something else. And the Equity Committee also noticed that discrepancy, but there's this misalignment between what the actual presentation was and what the description was. Perhaps that's because they only had 40 words. They couldn't say everything that they wanted to say in the description. So we know that some of the other proposals like PMENA, NCTM, they all have longer word count for descriptions. So this year we have increase the word count to 100 words. So there is more place for you to describe what your proposal is about. We specifically recommend that you pay attention to the following. Tell us something about the setting in which the study takes place.
Yeah.
Is it early childhood? Is it in-service teachers? Whatever it might be. What's the specific focus of the proposal? And then you can talk about the math content, algebra, geometry, interdisciplinary connections, something else. And also you could have a sentence or two about key areas of findings and who might find your session particularly helpful. And I think that will actually benefit the membership more, in addition to the reviewers, because we are looking through the, we have those app and we are reading those descriptions. And if there's a word about, say, coaches will find this extremely helpful, or methods course instructors will find this very helpful,
oh,
or this is for exceptional education faculty, I think that will actually be super helpful for those first-time attendees or for those folks that are specifically looking for sessions based on their interest. So I believe that, we believe that the 100-word description will help you provide all these details that will help not only the reviewers, but also the membership.
Yeah, and that was a constraint that was for a printed program. And given that most of, you know, we're doing PDFs now, it's like, make that thing long, long as you want, right? Or it's in the app or whatever. Yeah. So that's good.
There's one additional thing that I want to feature. This is new, 2025. Hybrid sessions.
Mm.
Have you heard of that before? No. So the board presented this idea to the committee and asked us to debate on that. So the goal was to broaden participation in the conference and promote inclusivity. So this is something that we are trying for the first time. So we will live stream a limited number of breakout sessions during the 2025 conference. During this pilot year, two breakout rooms will be designated as hybrid rooms, where the presenters will simultaneously interact with both in-person as well as online audiences. So if you want your proposal to be considered for the hybrid session, there is a box on All Academic that you can check. And then that's how we will know that you're wanting to present as your session as a hybrid session. What we also ask that is you thoughtfully assess how your session will engage both audiences, the in-person audience as well as the online audience, and please include details in your proposal on how you plan to engage both audiences. And at this time, for this pilot year, we also require that at least one presenter from each hybrid session attend the conference in person. This is number one, to manage the technology. Number two, most importantly, to facilitate informed interactions and dialogue on your topic. Only you are in a position to do that, not a member from the program committee. So they were very excited about these hybrid sessions. And again, like I said, this is pilot, so there'll be much that we can learn from this. So I wanted to highlight that aspect as well.
Nice. These sound like some really exciting changes that I think can just enhance the experience of AMTE conference attendees, whether they be in person or if they can't come in person, they can at least participate in some of these hybrid events. This is great work, Nirmala. Thank you.
I'll pass this to our committee.
Yeah. Well, and I like it feels like there's a story here too. And we kind of been talking about shoulder tapping a bit about getting involved and and there's things of getting involved. Like one, do those surveys when the links come out, do the surveys. Cause like, obviously you're using some of that feedback. And also two, just some of the involvement of the equity committee, the technology committee, all of them are pouring in to try to enhance what's going on at the conference. So that's great. Reviewing though, because that needs to happen before we have a conference. We got to, in all these proposals now, given the weight of this TMT podcast episode, I mean, this is gonna be a flood of proposals coming in. And I'm just going to nudge Jen. I would love to see Jen do a hybrid session. I think she would do a great job maybe we'll do one, Jen. Anyway, because Jen's really good about thinking about resiliency with regards to technology and whatever. Anyway, her eyes are still wide. But anyway, given all these proposals coming in, but also too, there's a spot where you can volunteer to be a reviewer as well, or you're committed. Yep. But I think it's also one of our responsibilities to be a reviewer as well. So what does it take to be a reviewer of proposals? What kind of special characteristics do you need to have? And I'm saying that in a facetious sort of way.
So thank you so much for touching on this topic. You would have seen when the call for proposals went out, there is a paragraph in there that says, if you are considering reviewing, if you're considering submitting a proposal, please, please do sign up to be a reviewer. We need you. It takes an army to put together a conference. And specifically, yes, when it comes to reviewing, the more the reviewers, then it's easier for those that have already signed up. If you have more reviewers, each reviewer gets to review a few proposals. If there are fewer reviewers, then the workload on those reviewers, it's just multiplies. So I can't stress the importance of someone to sign up as a reviewer. We've had reviewers, first-time reviewers, we have them. We've had grad students sign up as first-time reviewers. We have had early career faculty serve as reviewers. We have mid-career faculty. We have more experienced faculty serve as reviewers. So yes, we will invite you. We will take you. And we have a mechanism for assigning reviewers to different proposals. So at this time, whether you're submitting a proposal or not, please sign up to be a reviewer. That's what, no special.
Yeah.
I know you asked that question, but a willingness to serve as a reviewer and interest and some expertise in math teacher education fields.
Yeah.
Grad students, early career faculty, mid career faculty, experienced faculty. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's response. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Dustin.
I was going to say sometimes when I'm submitting a proposal to AMTE, and then I see the checkbox, do you want to be a reviewer? I think, well, it won't hurt me in my chances to get accepted. I actually don't think, and having been program chair a while ago, I know I didn't look and say, well, I'm trying to choose between two people, and Joel reviewed and Jen did not, so it's going to Joel. It doesn't go that way. What I think is helpful is you get a chance to look at a set, and the number of proposals that you look at is inversely proportional with the number of reviewers that there are. But you get to look at some really interesting sort of cutting edge type of thought, and you get an insight into what other people are working on. So it's kind of beneficial to you to not only share your expertise on kind of evaluating these against a rubric. I think a rubric is provided, so yeah, reviewers know what to say or know what to measure this against. But it also is a way to just get to know what's going on in the field, what's new, what's interesting, what some different people are working on. You don't know the people because they're blindly reviewed, but I found that to be very interesting. And you feel better, I guess, or I have felt better of thinking, well, I'm reviewing, so this might, you know, pay something forward. And I think also just with that mechanism of assigning reviewers, you if you might be thinking, well, I don't really know enough to review a proposal, I would disagree. I think you probably know enough. And then these proposals are not reviewed by only one person. These proposals are reviewed by multiple people. And I think that mechanism that's employed is trying to make sure that if two people are brand new to this process for AMTE, they're not the only people looking at that particular proposal. So we try to help lots of people get lots of experience. And I think it's great. Yeah, sign up to review. You've almost convinced me to review. I don't know if I'm there on submitting the proposal yet, but yeah.
Jen, and again, the whole idea about reviewing too, and I don't know what your first experience was. I mean, and Dusty's talking about some of the value. Like, I remember just me, it was like, I'm getting a insight into like what other people are citing. I thought that was interesting because it usually, you know, typically it was something I was interested in. But then also just even to see like, okay, well, these what proposals look like. Yes, there's a description. But I remember even before I was submitting proposals, like being, you know, getting to see and review some things was always interesting because I was like, okay, or even like submitting my first one and be like, okay, now I'm going to review some. And it's like, okay, I submitted something that looked like that or not like that. And like, you get to see like what success looks like. I don't know. Did you find any value? What values did you find in when you first started reviewing, Jen?
I think a couple of things, looking at the folks that people were citing in their work. And so that kind of got me excited to kind of explore other things I might be interested in. I think it's also a way to, for me, it was like challenging myself to get better at how do I give good feedback? Like, what does that look like? What does that sound like? How do I highlight strengths while also like stretches within that work? Because I think we all talk about that notorious reviewer too.
Yeah.
And so thinking about ways that I can give feedback in a more humanizing way.
Yes.
And what does that look like? Because in our roles, we're always giving feedback as teachers, right? So how can I become better at giving feedback mm-hmm. in ways that are receptive to other people where they'll take action on it, right? And I think that's something that we do in our research, our teaching, and our service.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for all the additional, the value added components to the review process. I appreciate that. And this probably goes without saying, but we all understand the importance of maintaining confidentiality during this whole review process. Mm. We trust each other with one of the largest responsibilities for AMTE each year, having that confidentiality, a key component of the process, and keeping an equitable lens with respect to all AMTE members is our primary responsibility. So I just want to add to what you all have said.
Yeah. As well, we talked a lot about math teacher education. What is something that you like to do outside of your role as a teacher of math teachers?
Oh, gosh. Well, I volunteer at a local language school. So I get to speak my language at home, but not otherwise. So we have the local community here. So they have where they have this weekend language school. So here's an opportunity for me to go and teach my language. It's very interesting because the children, they're children from grades K through 8. And the reason I became a volunteer is because I enrolled my daughter in that school. The only way she would go is if I went with her. And so I would go with her and I would have these 2 hours not knowing what to do. And they said, hey, we need volunteers to do some of the things here. Would you mind? I said, not at all. I will help. So that's how I became involved in that. My daughter started in kindergarten. She's now in grade 7. So I've been doing this for almost 7 years now. So I love doing that. And I see how children effortlessly switch code switching between the two languages. Mm. And it has actually helped broaden my own vocabulary in both languages. I didn't think that this would happen. So I think that's an added value that I got as a result of this volunteering opportunity. Gardening. I know it's springtime. So I haven't started my gardening projects for this year. So waiting to do that. Jen pointed out the semester is winding down. So it's ours here in about a couple of weeks. I would do that. I don't consider myself as an expert gardener, but I grow some good flowers. So there I'm waiting for that. I'm also a full-time caregiver for my 82-year-old mom, which keeps me quite busy otherwise. These are some of the things that I do. Sometimes I just put my feet up and not do anything.
There we go. That's good too. That's good too.
And I look forward to days like that.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So we've got a lot to promote here. So we're talking about putting in a proposal to AMTE. We're talking about signing up for a reviewer. I'm going to tack on to that we're all involved with in leadership roles within AMTE, that volunteer form is there for that's a nice way where people can step in into some of these roles, lots of roles out there in AMTE, whether it's technology committee, equity committee, all the different roles that could be out there. So to step in, and we can put a link to that volunteer form into the show notes. Anything else to promote or share? Any work that you got coming out that you want to promote, or anything that's recently come out, anything on the horizon? Normal. Yeah.
No, I'm very excited that at the University of North Texas here, we have we are now ready to accept students into our new Master's in Science Math Education Concentration Program. We also have a dual credit certification program. Everything is in the book, so it's out there, and nice. We are ready to accept students. So that's something that I want to promote.
Nice. We can put those out there. And then you're busy with the planning for Reno in 2025. So
absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So the program committee is working full time they'll be very busy between the months of April, May, June, and July. So that's the busiest time of the year for the program committee. So I want to add to what Joel said. If this is the sort of work that you're interested in getting involved, just go and fill out that volunteer form. I remember filling out volunteer forms many years ago to serve AMTE, and that's how I got involved with AMTE. I served on the awards committee, and then I served on the program committee for almost 4 years before I took on this role. So I have learned a lot through these experiences. So this is a very busy time of the year. The program committee and the conference committee itself will be meeting later in May, do a site visit and come up with more important details about the conference itself for those attending the conference. So please watch out for those announcements from the AMTE leadership about that. And if you have any questions about the program itself, please email using the link on the call proposals.
Yeah.
programchair@amte.net is the email.
Very good. Awesome. Well, thank you.
It's super easy to register as a volunteer. One might have been able to do it while joining in this conversation.
There you go.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. And thanks again for everyone out there for listening to the Teaching Math Teaching Podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to the podcast. We hope that you're able to take action on something you just heard of all that stuff and interact with other math teacher educators. Also, did you know that AMTE has another podcast, the MathMax Teacher Educator Podcast? The MTE podcast accompanies the latest edition of the MathMax Teacher Educator Journal and has authors discuss the work they have submitted for publication to the journal. Find a link to the MTE podcast in the show notes for this episode.